I'd like to begin this session. It's a session about promotion to professor, to run through some of the procedures and the requirements. We had a similar session in December, and if you were at that session, I'm not saying anything different from that time. Part of the reason for doing this is because of revisions to the regulations that were introduced last year that actually lay out, we hope, more clearly what the expectations and requirements are. So this is to help you either if you're thinking of requesting consideration for promotion, or if you are on a departmental or faculty committee dealing with promotion. It's really to help you through the processes and procedures. There will be time for questions and discussion at the end. But before we begin, I'd like to introduce you to Bonnie Bornstein, who is the person in the secretariat who deals with promotion dossiers when they've gone through the department and the faculty and are coming forward for a statutory selection committee. And she may have some information to add after I've had my say. So, well, I've really said this. The relevant regulations are the regulations relating to the employment of tenure track and tenured academic staff, and Section 8 is about promotion. You can get these the regulations from the Secretariat, and also the Secretariat has guidelines for the dossier available on their webpage, and these guidelines are currently being revised. So a new version of the Secretariat guidelines will be up in the next few weeks. But there are some guidelines there at the moment. So one thing to bear in mind, as far as promotion is concerned, this is unlike reappointment and unlike tenure. There's no specified timing. And the range of timing for when people go up for promotion consideration is enormous. So, you know, it could be 5 years, could be 15 years. In part, this is up to you as associate professors as to when you feel ready. But also, one of the things we're trying to encourage is that department chairs talk to their faculty members, discuss with them the best time to consider going up for promotion. So a department chair can, in fact, recommend that a staff member be considered at any time. Well, of course, that is provided the staff member agrees. But if you, as a staff member, would like your department to consider you, you have to be have been an associate professor for at least 5 years. And then there is a provision for staff members who have been associate professors for 10 years to make a request not via the department. I'll talk about this a bit more later on. But I just want to make it clear here that the normal route, even if you have been an associate professor for 10 years or more, is to go through your department and then through your faculty. So this third exception I will discuss a little bit later on. As far as promotion is concerned, your academic duties are what are taken into consideration, as they are for reappointment and tenure. So research and other scholarly activities, professional activities relating to research, your teaching at various levels and of various types, and your other contributions, which we typically call service. So service to the university and to whatever scholarly community is relevant for your field. The criteria are perhaps a little bit different from tenure in that particular emphasis is placed by the statutory selection committees on your record of excellence in research, and particularly as evidenced by international recognition. So this is, I would say, it's what the statutory selection committees look at first. Mm. Okay. But you also require a record of high-quality teaching and a substantial record of service. So some ways in which you might demonstrate in your dossier that you are internationally recognized, and of course there are more ways than these, but these are the kinds of things that people often draw attention to. So your publications, your success in obtaining research grants. Now these are very similar to requirements for tenure. Any awards and honors that you've received for your research. Are you an editor of an international journal or on the editorial board? By the way, these slides will be made available to you online afterwards, and so will the whole presentation. If you've been involved in organizing international conferences and the like, if you have been invited as a speaker at international conferences, in other words, because of your reputation, again, if you're involved in professional organizations that relate to your field. So those kinds of things can demonstrate international recognition. And it is, as always, with reappointment, tenure, and promotion, it's the responsibility of the candidate to present their case in a way that will convince the various committees that promotion is merited, or recommendation for promotion is merited. But it is indeed the responsibility of chairs of departments, directors of schools, and so on, to provide you with guidance as to whether promotion is appropriate at a particular time, or when the appropriate time would be. So your dossier as a candidate will include certain things that you provide, and then other things get added to it. So what we're looking for, so one thing, I should make it clear that the statutory selection committees are complaining about the size of some of the dossiers. They do not like 100-page dossiers. And so we're trying to encourage people to put across the important information, but not with pages and pages and pages of justification. And there's all sorts of things you don't need to include. Like, you do not need to include copies of letters from funding councils saying that you got a grant, or, you know, letters from a committee chair saying that you have been appointed to such and such a committee. The kinds of things that can just be listed in your CV should be listed in your CV. And, you know, we assume that you are not lying, and you don't need to back up every single statement that's or every single line in the CV. But you do need to provide a personal statement that covers your contributions to research, teaching, and service. And you need to provide a detailed CV that includes a list of your publications. You may have other materials that you wish to submit. And let me make it, this is important. We are not requiring teaching portfolios from people who are being considered for promotion, unlike tenure. But you may want to look at the guidelines for developing a teaching portfolio, the revised guidelines in the new version of the regulations, which again are trying to simplify this, because even though we don't ask you for a portfolio, the guidelines do outline the kinds of things you should be talking about in your teaching statement, the kinds of things that will convince a committee of your excellence in teaching. So in addition to your actual dossier, you can include a number of appendices. We suggest a selection of your publications, not all of them. I'll come back to that in a moment. Any other material you think is relevant, but but you know, be careful not to include too much or stuff that's merely confirming information that's actually already in your CV, for example. So just as far as publications are concerned, there seems to be enormous variation across the university as to whether departments and faculties, when they're looking at the dossiers, require copies of publications, and how many they want. And one thing that has come up from time to time in those departments and faculties where books are expected, should you be providing copies of books? And this is something certainly you need to check in your department and your faculty. But in some cases, the secretariat, if you want a book to be considered and it's to go to the external reviewers, then you will have to supply a copy or more than one copy of a book. But by the time your dossier gets to the statutory selection committee, that committee is not reading your publications. They are concerned about quantity and quality of publication, but that committee is no longer an expert committee that can assess the quality of your publications, whereas at the departmental level, one presumes the department is able to assess the quality, and at the faculty level probably as well. So how many publications, what form they should take, is something you need to establish at the local level as you put your dossier together. Yes, if you have a question, could you put your light on to get the mic working? Yeah.
Just thinking that we're preparing our dossiers not only for the department and for the statutory selection committee, but also for the external reviewers.
Yes.
So in that sense, you know, having a couple key publications right. included is probably a good idea.
Yeah, no? I absolutely agree. Yes, bear that in mind. Your dossier is going to go to some external reviewers. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. And, you know, on the one hand, when people ask me to review dossiers, I usually say, I don't want the publications, I've already got them. But you can't rely on that. So yes, you should be including key publications as an appendix. But don't include all. And I would say it's advisable when you're writing your research statement to link what you say in your statement to the publications that you choose to append so that people can see why those publications are an important part of what you want to convey. Yeah. Okay, so that's your part of the dossier, but then other things get added after you've submitted. So at least three external evaluator reports are solicited by the dean. You and your chair, I'll probably say this later, but you and your chair will have put together a list of potential evaluators, a list of six names. At least three are required. Very often more than three are obtained. The chair of your departmental promotion committee will write a written recommendation reporting what the departmental committee has decided. And then that recommendation, your dossier, the departmental recommendation are forwarded to the dean, and some faculties have faculty advisory committees, and that committee, which will have seen the external letters as well, will write a recommendation, which will then move forward to the statutory selection committee. So in terms of the external evaluators, we ask for a list of six names, and the people, you need to be thinking carefully about people who can evaluate your scholarship, your research, who are themselves of recognized standing and qualified to provide an evaluation. I'll just mention, this actually arose in the case, I think, of tenure, not promotion, a year or so ago, where somebody was invited to be an external, or somebody provided an external evaluation, who turned out to be only an assistant professor. You need to make sure that the names, the people you're proposing, are, if not full professors, associate professors who are very well recognized in their field. So junior faculty are not except in very exceptional circumstances, which would have to be justified, are not suitable. And of course, the external evaluators must not be in a conflict of interest with you. So this list is put together by you in conjunction with your department chair, but it's the dean, in the normal process, it's the dean who selects, who solicits letters from at least three of the names. So just to, some of this has been implicit in what I've already said, but there are three levels of review. So there's your departmental committee, and it's the department that determines the membership. And again, we get a lot of variation here. So in some departments, only full professors can serve on a promotion committee. In other departments, any tenured faculty member can serve on the committee. I don't know. Well, those are the two main variants that I'm aware of. And your department shouldn't be making up sort of ad hoc procedures. In other words, this should be established within the department. Yes, question.
Hello, I'm Faith Wallace from Social Studies of Medicine and History. I'm jointly appointed not only in two departments, but in two faculties.
Yes.
Which department initiates this? Do I have to choose one or the other, or is a joint committee formed?
Yes, I think I'm going to get to that, okay. but in case I don't, I'm pretty sure I've got it somewhere. It should be a joint committee. So in other words, if one department thinks you're ready and the other does not, it isn't up to you to sort this out. They've got to sort it out. But normally, and of course we're going to get more and more cases like this. They've been relatively unusual up to now. It should be a joint committee, and if it's different faculties, the two departments have got to agree on who's going to chair that committee, or are they going to have co-chairs? When it goes up to the next level, both faculty level committees have got to agree. So yes, it's not as straightforward in the cases of joint appointments, especially ones like yours, which cross faculties. So in the normal case, well, at least what's currently the normal case, a recommendation from one department goes up to that department's faculty. And in some faculties, as I said before, there is an advisory committee to the dean, and others there's not. But again, this committee is something where the faculty has already determined how the membership of that committee is appointed. And then the final level of review is the so-called statutory selection committee, which is a committee that's advisory to the principal. So each of these levels, the committees are not making decisions, but recommendations, right? Department recommends to faculty, faculty recommends to the statutory selection committee, and that committee recommends to the principal. The statutory selection committee is chaired by the provost, and the typical membership is as follows. Two members of the board of governors, one vice principal, the dean of your faculty, two members of Senate, two members selected by Senate. They might not be members of Senate. And such other members as the principal may see fit, and typically it'll be the chair of your department. And then there's a secretary from the secretariat, very often Bonnie. So let's go back to the first level of review. So the departmental promotion committee meets, considers the dossier after receiving it from the candidate. And where they make a recommendation in favor of promotion, they, as I said before, they submit a report to the dean. They are to do this within 3 months of receiving your dossier. We're trying to improve the timeline on promotion. If the promotion committee feels you're not ready, they are to inform you again within 3 months. The fact that you a promotion committee might say, you know, you're not ready now doesn't mean that you can get another kick at the can and another. But if that happens to you, it's worth talking to the chair about what do they think about the timing of another approach to the committee. But if the recommendation has been positive, the dean consults his or her committee and solicits the external letters. So it's the dean who's going to be providing the externals with the candidate's dossier. And if the dean recommends in favor, it has to be a written recommendation. You will get a copy of the dean's recommendation. And you won't get a copy of the external letters, but the dean submits these to the secretariat. And again, we're asking deans to make their recommendation within 3 months of receiving the promotion committee report. And if the dean is against promotion, letting you know in good time. So, top level, the Secretary General informs people that a selection committee will be established. And the candidate now, so at the moment, what's happening is there isn't a requirement for an electronic form of the dossier at the first two committees, but by the time you get to the secretariat, the dossier should be electronic. So we're strongly advising that it's actually electronic all the way up. And you do have the opportunity to, unlike tenure, where after certain dates you can't add things to your dossier, for promotion you can. So for example, you could add stuff at this point, and you can add stuff earlier. So when the Secretary General has received the complete dossier, a committee is convened within 30 working days. It meets. And if it makes a positive recommendation, in fact, this committee gives permission to the dean and chair who are present at the committee meeting to communicate the decision to the candidate. The actual official promotion doesn't take place until after the board has confirmed it, but the board has never turned down a recommendation from this committee. So basically, your promotion takes place on the first day of the month after the board has approved. And again, if the recommendation is against promotion, you'll be provided with reasons, with written reasons. So as I've sort of alluded to, The normal route for anyone, regardless of how long they've been an associate professor, is that route I've just described, department, faculty, statutory selection committee. But there are cases where people feel, for various different reasons, that the departmental committee or possibly the faculty committee will not be the right committee to be looking at them. This could be an enormous number of reasons, but including bias and other things. And so, unusually and very atypically, there is this provision for somebody who's been an associate professor for at least 10 years to, in some sense, bypass certain stages, although you'll see in a moment it isn't a true bypass, but to go straight to the principal and say, for these reasons, and you do have to explain why the normal route is not going to work, I would like to be considered directly by a statutory selection committee. However, when you make such a request, your dossier doesn't go straight to the statutory selection committee. Your department and your faculty are still asked if they would like to provide input. So the candidate makes the request. Instead of depositing the dossier with the department, it goes straight to the secretariat. The list of names of externals, instead of discussing this with your chair, it's discussed with the provost, or in fact, probably with me as the provost delegate in this case. And so it's the provost's office that does the soliciting of the letters, not the dean's office. But the departmental promotion committee is asked if they would like to make a recommendation, and they may or may not choose to do so. And similarly, the dean is asked if he or she would like to make a recommendation and may choose not to do so. And of course, the statutory selection committee is going to be aware that the recommendations that come from these two levels are not necessarily of the same status as ones where people have come through the normal process. So then there's a meeting of the statutory selection committee. That process is very unusual. Very few cases have been advanced over the years that way, but the provision exists, and I would strongly recommend, if anyone feels that they need to use that route and that you can't talk to your chair about it, talk to me, or talk to somebody, talk to a mentor. Is this a sensible way of proceeding? What are the pitfalls? What are the advantages? And so on. So just to wrap up, so as far as associate professors are concerned, we strongly encourage you to talk to your chairs about the possibility of promotion, when is a good time to be considered. And we're encouraging chairs and indeed deans to mentor people in the associate professor category, to help them. We've heard of a number of cases of people who haven't really been sure whether they should go forward, and who probably, if somebody such as their chair talked to them, they would actually realize, oh yes, perhaps I should be doing this. So we do need chairs and directors to get perhaps more involved in encouraging people to go forward. So here's an possible issue, which is, is it the case, and this might be a reason why one would want to go the unusual route, could it be the case that some departments and faculties are requiring more than the university is for promotion, or that they're requiring less? So it's important that there's some sort of general understanding of what the criteria for promotion are at all levels, and that there aren't wild discrepancies at each level in terms of what the expectations are. So, I'm here. Well, I'm normally in my office. And if you have any questions about the regulations, about interpreting the section on promotion, or about questions about should you be putting your name forward, or if you're a chair or a dean, who should you be encouraging, this is one of the things that I am therefore, so please feel free to consult me. So that's all that I have to say. I can see hands, and there'll be a lot of questions, but before we get to questions and discussion, Bonnie, is there anything you'd like to add from the point of view of the secretariat? Can you use the mic? Yeah.
Just to highlight that the guidelines are in the process of being reevaluated or reestablished, and they will be published to the web probably within the next month or so. So it would be worth your while to check back at that time to see what guidelines are available.
Yes.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about, I think it ties in with, okay, the idea that our department's regulations should, of course, be in line with the universities. I have this sneaky feeling that my departments are not, in the sense that, my question is this, in terms of service, my department seems to have a bias towards service done in the department as opposed to service done outside. And I want to know if that's the university's position or if that's, right? So when we're out and about doing our things at the association and you're president of this and that, they seem to weigh that less than if you're chair of the department or GPD, right? And of course, we're all doing different things, and the way that they actually assign these things doesn't necessarily mean that everybody will ever get a chance to be the chair of the GPD. So then people can be kind of, you know, of course, at a disadvantage then when they come up if there's that bias between internal and external service. So is that the university's position, or is that?
It's right? Not the university's position. And that's an interesting discrepancy. And I know there are some departments that have, in a sense, the opposite bias. They want the service component to show service at the faculty or university level and not just the department. But it seems to me this is something where one has to, it has to vary actually on a case-by-case basis, right? Mm-hmm. But certainly if, I think it would be a concern if the department has a, it's not exactly a policy, but a preference for a certain kind of service, because anything, you know, university level service or service to your professional organization, all of those things count and are considered very important at the university level, by the university.
So how do we circumvent that in the dossier? Because my feeling in my department is that it's an unwritten bias, right? So you can't say that they wrote it down and said this, but when they all get together and do the vetting, that's what comes out in the conversations, right? So you can't even, you can't really rebut it because it's not something they put in print.
Right.
Right? But it's something they all kind of agree upon. So then the person who's working in a different way is disadvantaged, and then, you know, thank God for the 10-year thing, but who wants to wait 10 years if you've otherwise, you know, feel like you've done what it takes? That's not fair, right?
So I think you and I should talk,
separately
off the record. but certainly, but it's a good example of a possible discrepancy at different levels where, you know, the department has one set of expectations and the faculty probably has a different set, and certainly at the, I would say, just from the statutory selection committees I've sat on, the expectation is not just, of course there's service in the department, that you gave the example graduate program director, which is a major role, right, so very important. But often the committees are looking for service beyond just the department. So we can talk about that a bit more. I saw another, yes.
I have two questions. And, one is, if the department chair is an associate professor, can he participate, be a member?
Interesting question. And I know of departments where that's not a problem at all, and the department chair is the chair of the promotion committee. And I know of other departments which have a I know of at least one department, one of the ones that has a requirement that everyone is on the committee, everyone on the committee is a full professor, so the chair of the department cannot be the full chair of the committee, and instead, you know, one of the full professors is chosen to chair the promotion committee. This will vary from department to department.
And would the candidate have any say in the membership?
No. So the membership of the promotion committee should not be set up at the last minute because a particular person is putting their dossier forward. It should be known in your department who is normally on the promotion committee, who normally chairs it. Now, and does your department have a prohibition against associate professors being on the committee? So if this is not known in your department, it's something you should ask your chairs, not just for your own case, but in general. Could you please make it clear who are the members of the department committee? And similarly, the faculty level, this should be public knowledge. Who is on the faculty promotion committee?
If there are not enough, if there are not enough professors, can they have a professor from outside?
Ah, that's an interesting question. Yes. Yeah. So, first of all, unlike the tenure committees where we say you must have a minimum of X, there is no specified minimum membership of the committee, but obviously two people would not be enough. So what should happen in the case of a department that is small and has this restriction about full professors? I actually think that small departments don't have that restriction precisely for that reason. Is it appropriate to bring in, for the department to bring in other members? It seems to me, again, it's difficult to decide in the abstract, because you wouldn't want members of a departmental promotion committee who are not familiar with the kind of research that's being conducted in the department, who are not familiar with the department in general. So on the whole, I would say that's not advisable, but I can see there might be circumstances where a department feels the need to do that. Of course, the case of joint appointments, which I said I would get back to, that's different. There it's necessary to ensure that both units, who may be very different from each other, but the joint appointee is a member of both departments, they both need to be represented. They both need to be represented at the departmental level and at the faculty level. But the situation you're outlining is slightly different, and I don't know, I would be, as a former department chair, I would be slightly uncomfortable about having members on a promotion committee who were from a different department, unless it was very closely associated. Yeah. Yes?
I have a question about the contents of the dossier.
Yeah.
I'm in the Department of Psychiatry, and I've actually been submitting the dossier to them since February, so they could have a look at it and give me feedback and so on. And they requested a cover letter that, in two pages, kind of summarized the contents of the personal statement. And then for the personal statement, they said maximum 6 pages. And then I was surprised when they wanted the final dossier that I submit to them to have both the cover letter and the personal statement, which are somewhat redundant. I'm confused. I'm confused about whether I ought to be submitting a cover letter as well as a personal statement, and if there really is a 6-page limit, because I'm like cutting back on paragraphs and I'm spending a lot of time forcing it into 6 pages.
So again, it's, we do not at the university level tell departments or candidates what the length requirements are. All I can tell you is the statutory selection committees hate long dossiers. I wouldn't worry too much about the redundancy issue, because I think the statutory selection committees will actually like the fact that you've got a summary covering statement. Reducing your personal statement to 6 pages, as I can see that could be quite difficult. And just bear in mind that you can add to the dossier at any point. So what you might want to do is keep a short version for your department and then reinsert the slightly longer version that you feel more comfortable with when it goes to the faculty and the statutory selection committee.
What's the typical length of the personal statement?
Bonnie, do you have any idea?
It really varies from faculty to faculty. There's nothing very typical, but the comments, I sit on the SSEs, and the comments are really to keep the whole dossier under 100 pages, and the summary statements are very much appreciated, actually, so not to worry too much about redundancy.
Okay, but is 6 pages, like, really tiny? Is it
seems
typical?
Short
is
to
it?
Me.
It seems, if you're uncomfortable with it, I think Lydia's response in that, if that's the requirement for your department, so be it, and submit it that way to the department, but you can alter it for the faculty.
Yeah. 6 pages seems short to me because we're no longer requiring a teaching dossier. This means you've got to get what you want people to notice about your teaching into that statement. The research component is, you know, at least laying out what your main lines of research, the way the major contribution you've made. And service, again, you know, now a lot of this service stuff can just be covered in the CV when you list all the things that you're doing. But no, I agree with you, 6 pages is not very much. I mean, this is the first time I'm hearing of a department saying, I mean, in my department, the personal statements are much longer than 6 pages. They're more like 15.
Because 6 pages is a lot harder to write than
it is.
20.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yes, question at the back.
First of all, thanks very much for putting on this information session. I've got a couple of questions, and I may have missed the content if you already covered it, because I had to go out a couple of times. The first one has to do with candidates that come into the university at the associate professor level and then are tenured afterwards,
right.
if there's a minimum amount of time between the awarding of tenure and consideration for promotion to full professor. I don't know if you want to answer that first, and then
I'll answer
second.
That first. There isn't a minimum amount of time if the invitation to be considered has come from your chair. If it's you initiating, it's the same as everybody else. You have to have been 5 years associate professor at McGill, not somewhere else. Let me make one other point of clarification. People sometimes ask in those cases, so we have people appointed as a tenure track associate professors who are then considered for tenure, and sometimes we're asked, is there automatic promotion going along with tenure? And the answer is no. So the two processes are distinct.
Okay, thank you. The second question, maybe you showed this, but I remember when going through the whole tenure process, there were data on how the proportion of candidates that were successful. So I'm wondering if you can say anything about how likely it is that a candidate will be promoted, and if obviously there'll be cases where people are unsuccessful. If you can tell us if that's more likely to happen at the departmental, faculty, or SSC level.
Right. So this question is hard to answer because unlike tenure, where we know when a departmental tenure committee makes a negative recommendation, and we know when the university tenure committee makes a negative recommendation. In the case of the promotion process, we don't know how many cases were turned down at the departmental level or the faculty level. We only know what happens at the statutory selection committee, where it is very rare. So if you have got through the three steps, or you've got to the third stage, it's very unlikely, it's not impossible, but it's very unlikely that a statutory selection committee would overturn the recommendation of two other committees. But I don't even have anecdotal evidence about how many people are turned down at the departmental level. But what I do know happens, in fact, I think one of you alluded to this, there are a lot of departments where if somebody submits a dossier, the department will actually be given, the departmental committee will take on a mentoring function and say, look, we would like to consider you, but can you do this, this, and this to your dossier to improve it? And so things that might, so is that turning them down, or is it just helping them along but taking longer? So, you know, we don't have those statistics. I mean, my impression is that on the whole, if, I shouldn't give anything impressionistic, because I just don't know. I don't know what the statistics are. Yeah. Yes.
Given the emphasis in the regulations on international profile and publication, I would be interested to hear your advice or thoughts for people whose work is primarily local. So if you're a Quebecist or if you're a Canadianist, international can look different. I mean, yes. Regardless of the quality of the work, right? Cambridge University Press is always going to think that something on Quebec is parochial.
Yes. I mean, this one's difficult. Mm. And I think what you have to have in front of you is a selling job, right? I mean, yeah.
Okay, so it's a rhetorical gesture that we need to make in the dossier.
Yes, I think so, yeah. Because, even if the research, presumably, even if the research is largely known in Quebec or Canada, not so much internationally, well, then try and choose in your list of names, you know, well-known figures in Canada who can speak to the value of the research and so on, and who could even speak to that issue of this is a research domain where it's, by the very nature of the research, harder to demonstrate international visibility.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
I have a few questions. Number one, yes, thank you for putting on this session. The first question is, what goes out to the external? Do they get the full dossier?
Yes.
They do get the full?
They don't get the reports. So it's at the dean's level that the externals are being solicited. They get your full dossier, but not anything that's been added in by anyone else. So they would not get the report that your departmental committee has written. But anything that you've put in, they will get. And this is where the issue has come up recently and presumably in the past should you be giving them extra material in the way of publications, and what happens if the publication is not something that can be used, can be a PDF file, but it's actually, you know, a book. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Because they do need, obviously the externals need enough in the way of published material to assess your impact. They're getting your dossier, plus you may want to be giving them things that your department said they didn't need, or your faculty says that it doesn't need.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. And the second question is probably a famous one you hear a lot. What's in it for us?
Ah, yes. What's in it for you? There's a salary increase. In fact, we had a session recently of the Academic Leadership Forum, and a lot of people asked that question. And the principal pointed out, it's not just that there's a $5,000 salary increase, but if you think about that over the years, you know, compounded and so on, it's far more than $5,000. There is status, recognition, those kinds of things. So it's true that a lot of people at McGill seem to feel, why bother? And this is why we're trying to cut down on what you have to prepare as far as your dossier is concerned, so that it isn't so much of a chore. Satisfaction. So money and satisfaction and recognition, that's what's in it for you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yes. Can you...
Since the teaching dossier is not required any longer, what is actually recommended to be included in the summary or in the personal statement on along the lines of teaching. Is there anything recommended to be included?
Well, I think you still need to argue that, you know, for the excellence of your teaching, so the kinds of things that would have gone into a teaching dossier, such, for example, a table showing the courses you've taught, the results of course evaluations, a list of your graduate students and their successes, some of that can go in the CV. So this is why I'm saying,
So part of the CV, actually, will replace the teaching dossier.
Right. That's quite right. Part of the CV will replace the teaching dossier, and part of the CV is the research dossier, right? This is why we want a list of publications. It's true, in your CV, you can include the courses that you've taught, the students that you've supervised, but you may want to say a bit more about that in your statement.
But for example, the students' evaluations, there's no place for it anymore.
Well, I would still put them in your. I would still mention them in your teaching statement, and then you can have an appendix with the evaluations. What we do not want, and the committees do not want, is all those detailed comments from students about how you taught, but. The committees are still quite interested in the numerical evaluations showing how you've done or how you compare to the departmental average and so on. So keep some of that in, but not as much as you would have done in a full teaching dossier.
Of course. Yeah. I have another question. If a person applying for promotion has letters from other very recognized either researchers, persons in the field, or else institutions. Is it possible to include those letters of support on top of giving the list of evaluators?
Right. The answer really is no, you shouldn't do this, because it won't be clear to the committee whether those people are at arm's length, right? They might be your buddies. You might have collaborated with them on research. So this is why the list is drawn up where you and the chair, you satisfied your chair, and then you actually have to justify the choice of people, that the people on the list are at arm's length. They've got no vested interest in supporting you. So it's the same for tenure. We don't allow additional recommendations that have been sought by the candidate. There might be some exceptions. So, for example, if you are working with a team of researchers, you might want somebody to indicate that your role on the team is central, et cetera, et cetera. Those letters would be okay, yes.
For example, I do have such a collaboration with the Collège de France, and I was thinking that, since the collaboration is extensive, and those people are willing to provide letters of support, maybe that would be a suitable
right.
Idea.
So again, I mean, this is the kind of thing, if you put it in, the committees might say, we're going to set this to one side, or they might take it into consideration. Faith?
No, I just wanted to ask a bit more about the issue of how long the arm has to be.
yes, okay.
The length of the arm. So. Somebody who is part of the same international research consortium or team would be okay?
It depends. I'm saying that those people you can often have as extra, because if they're talking not so much about the nature of your research, but just making it clear that, this person is not just a name on my team, but is actually a fully functioning member. I wouldn't count that as one of the externals, but it could be extra information. These things often have to be discussed on a case-by-case basis. Is this at arm's length or isn't it? And certainly when you fill out the form indicating who you've chosen, It's the same for tenure. You have to indicate any possible relationship between you and the externals. And when the dean comes to deciding of the six names, shall I ask them all? Shall I ask three, four, five? The dean might eliminate somebody because they feel that they're too close to you, or they might contact your chair and say, you know, what do you think? Is this one really sufficiently at arm's length? But it's very, and then a question that often comes up, if you're in a very small field, what do you do when actually you know everybody else, right? So, of course, knowing, meeting people at conferences, that's fine. But if it's, sometimes you will need, I quite often get questions to me. Here's a situation. Do you think this is arm's length or not? And then I'll give an opinion. So it's probably advisable to consult in those kinds of cases. Yes.
Just quickly on that same thing, I am in a very small professional community. So do we just make a case then?
Because yes, you have to.
We're all doing things for each other,
right.
And we.
Yeah.
So we just make a case.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
By the way, if you finish speaking, can you turn off your mics, because it sometimes makes the recording harder? I saw a hand somewhere else. Yes.
I just have a question about process. So as you're trying to determine this list of six potential external evaluators, are you permitted to contact them ahead of time and ask them if they would function in that capacity or not?
You shouldn't do that. And for tenure, we actually say you may not do that. I noticed that we don't actually specify this, but it should really be your dean that's contacting them and not you first. Don't do the initial contact, just in case it in some way contaminates the process.
I had a question, which is the flip side of the one of what's in it for us. So you talked about the benefits for going up for full. I wonder what the expectations would be then, what the shift of expectations is between being an associate and being full.
Yes.
I mean, I can imagine some protections, if you will, from certain roles, staying as an associate professor. That would then be off if you were full.
Yes. So is it the case that by being promoted, you're suddenly expected to be on more committees or different committees, or, for example, in the departments where the promotion committee is only full professors, you're suddenly, taking on an extra role? You know, in 20 years ago, I would have said, because this certainly happened to me, that being a female full professor had its disadvantages, right? Because, you know, you want your nominal female on various committees. That's it's still true that we haven't got as many female, the proportion of female full professors is still lower than it should be. But I don't get the impression now that people are being asked to undertake extra duties because of being promoted. But there are other full professors in the room. I don't know if anyone has a different impression of that. I think on the whole, McGill expects service at all levels, so I'm not sure that that's much of a difference. Yeah. Can you put your mic on?
I'm a full professor in the physics department, and I mean, I think, you know, you're expected to be on so many committees as an associate professor and a similar number of committees as a full professor, and so it's just a question of what committees you would normally get assigned to in a reasonably large department anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That's my impression too, yes.
One of the things that's been unclear to me is if there are real deadlines, like twice a year. I mean, our department says there's a spring deadline and a fall deadline, and because it almost sounds like when there's enough people to form a committee will be formed. And a related question is, what I've heard is 18 months. Between the time you submit your dossier to when the Board of Governors blesses you. And
yeah. Okay, so the answers to these questions are related because you're in the Faculty of Medicine. So In the Faculty of Medicine, at the faculty level, they do have a committee meeting. I think it's only twice a year, is it? Yes, twice a year. So that's where you're getting, the department's getting that deadline. It's not a departmental deadline, and it's not our deadline. It's your faculty. And because the faculty, so in your faculty, when they've got a bunch together, they meet, and so this sometimes does delay the process. We are really trying to get the process down to less than a year. For a number of cases, this is now working, except that we don't always know how long it's taken in your department, right? How much back and forth has there been between you and your departmental committee? But it's our impression that we think 18 months is too long. We're trying to get it down to a year or less. And in a number of cases, we've been successful on that. As far as I know, the Faculty of Medicine is the only faculty that has set deadlines for considering promotion dossiers. Everybody else is doing it on a rolling basis, and the statutory selection committees are on a rolling basis. When you have the committee can meet, if there's only one candidate, usually there may be a couple dealt with at one time, but it's your faculty that's the block here.
But if the final step is for the Board of Governors to sign off on it, how often do they meet? How often could this happen at any time during the year?
Just to give you a better idea of what happens after the SSC. So in the SSC committee meeting, everyone that I've been to, every applicant has been promoted. I've never seen a denial yet. So at that point, I write up an abstract, and that's another reason why the summaries that are part of the resumes, that part of the applications, are very useful, because from that I draw an abstract, which goes to the Board of Governors. They meet approximately once a month. There's a set schedule, and it's public. You can find it on the Secretariat webpage. If it's not the Board of Governors, then the Executive Committee of the Board of Governors also meets, and it could pass through them as well. And they approve it, at which point the information goes to the APO office, and a letter is written by the Secretariat, sent to the APO office, sent to the candidate, letting them know that they've been appointed full professor. And it's usually for the month after the Board of Governor meets.
So it's not like once a year,
they entertain all
these.
It's really very much a rolling basis.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
That's not what it sounds like.
Yeah, so, yeah, no, if you, you might want to complain to your faculty about the fact that they only do it twice a year, because this does lead to delays. But on the other hand, you can understand why they're doing it that way. I mean, there are pluses and minuses to doing it, but nearly all other faculties do it on a rolling basis without any deadlines.
And just to interject, we just passed about 11 candidates from the Faculty of Medicine over the last month and a half.
Yeah, so following one of their more recent meetings, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it sounded like they get all batched.
They do in medicine, but not in other faculties.
To create the SSE, because the dean of the faculty of the applicant under consideration needs to be present at the SSE, plus the chair. In some ways, they do get batched. When there is an SSE meeting that's being created, it's best that we have five applicants to discuss from one faculty. But in other cases, if we have, let's say, some from arts and some from medicine, then we just have the Dean of Medicine in for the first hour and then the Dean of Arts for the second hour. So we do arrange it that way also.
Any other? Yes.
Hi. I'm just wondering if there's a way to circumvent the lack of transparency in submitting to the department without the faculty and anybody else knowing. It seems to me that that's a recipe for disaster in cases where there's internal bias in the department. The fact that the faculty wouldn't know when you're submitting, and they could just kill it, and nobody knows, and there's no, other input into this.
Right.
Like, what are our alternatives, or what are our, what's the recourse besides waiting the 10 years and going to the principal?
Right. I mean, this is a good question, and something that I'll need to think about. you know, should we at least be asking departments and faculties to report? Because, as I mentioned, we actually have no idea. I think this is a very, it's an important point, and let me take it under consideration. Is there something we can do about it? And if so, you know, what would it be? But the first step would be just to have the information, and we haven't even got that.
Sorry, I could just follow up about that by saying, when we do submit to the department, if they say no, do they have to give us a written statement saying why?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Yes.
So I came in at the associate professor level, and I actually wanted to, I had a position for 5 years before I came here, so I was actually interested in coming up for tenure as quickly as possible. I did so after my third year here, and I was told that the dossier could only be populated with the things that I had done in those 3 years that I was at McGill. So I'm just wondering, with the promotion to professor, are you also asked to look at a particular period of time? Is it since you were tenured? Is it since you were last promoted? Or is it a snapshot of your entire, or not even a snapshot, but a detailed report of your whole academic career?
Yeah, this is an interesting question, because you effectively, regarding the tenure issue, you effectively came up for early tenure, so you should actually have been allowed to go back into your previous position and take information for that into your dossier. With respect to promotion, so I think the assumption is it's mostly, you know, what you've done at McGill that would justify promotion, but the thing about promotion is it's your whole career, isn't it? So things that you've done before McGill, actually, especially on the research front, presumably feeding into things that. So that I see no objection to, in your research statement, for example, including, you know, showing how what you did before. It makes a continuation, or what you did now is in part a continuation of what you did before. Again, it's difficult to know how much the committees will take the earlier things into consideration. Certainly, if you were, you know, your performance was brilliant before and has sort of plateaued at McGill, then I think they won't be impressed. But if you're showing something like this, then I think they may, you know, look at the whole spectrum. But it's true that there's nothing written in these regulations about how far back can you go. And so, again, I think this is the kind of thing where it probably needs to be considered on a case-by-case basis, and, you know, maybe you know, what has been your department's practice in the past? Maybe talk about it to your chair. Yes.
You mentioned that the list of six potential reviewers, there's not a rule that they must be full professors. So if they're an associate professor, but they're well established in the field, they're a recognized name, that we can make that justification.
You can make that justification, but
might not work.
Your dean will probably, if he looks down the list and sees, you know, five full professors and one associate, he or she may say, okay, I'm just going to contact the full professors. I mean, so your justification has to be really strong. The strong preference is that these should be people who've already been promoted so that they have a sense of what the requirement. But on the other hand, what they're supposed to be talking about is your contributions. So, it could well be that an associate professor is in a better position to do that than some full professor who's less knowledgeable about your subfield or whatever. Yeah.
Just one final question about it. The guidelines you were mentioning, maybe this is for Bonnie, I'm not sure. You mentioned that they were being revamped or being rewritten. If we're doing our dossier now, should we just work with what we have, or should we wait? Are there going to be major changes? Is that a premature question?
I think some changes will be somewhat major.
How fast are you working on your dossier?
Well, just in talking to my chair, he said May. He'd like to have that.
Okay. Well, we'll likely have them up within the next few weeks or so.
Okay. So I could just contact you then as I...
Yes.
Or, okay. Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Am I correct that only full professors can become emeritus professors and that all full professors become emeritus professors?
First is correct, the second is not.
Okay.
Yes, so if you retire as a full professor, let's put it like this. If you retire as an associate, here's another reason to apply for promotion. If you retire as an associate professor, you cannot become an emeritus professor of McGill. If you retire as a full professor, your dean will consult with your chair to determine whether or not you should be emeritus. And in most cases now, most full professors who retire become emeritus, but there are certain exceptions. So there are certain criteria for appointment to emeritus, but I would say it's quite unusual for a full professor who retires not to become emeritus, but it's not guaranteed. But yes, that is a reason to be promoted. Yeah.
In that line of thought, can an external evaluator be an emeritus professor?
Yes.
Lydia, do you want to outline the advantages to emeritus?
The advantages to emeritus, well, it's a status thing. there are some advantages as an emeritus professor in terms of things that you have access to still at McGill that are not available to retired professors. So there are some more concrete, I can't remember the exact list, but there are some advantages, yeah. Any other questions or comments? So feel free to contact me or Bonnie if you have any questions arising out of this session or otherwise. And for those of you that are thinking about promotion, good luck. We hope it doesn't take 18 months.